Welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast. Podcast with two siblings who love books.
And that's novel spelled N-O-V-3-L and books spelled B-0-0-K-S.
Five, I think.
Five, yeah.
We are book hacksaws.
We are elite book hacksaws. Y'all are noobs.
Yeah, listen up, book noobs. We need to tell you about our spoiler policy.
Yeah, I was thinking we could tell them our names first, but...
Oh, well, I was trying to segue from noobs.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
I was trying to be professional. But I'm Ben.
I'm Gabs.
And I am not professional.
Yes, if you are a noob, we have absolutely no semblance of professionality. Our spoiler policy is very relevant today because Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, which is the book we are discussing, was published last year, this year, within the last 2 years.
Yeah, very recently.
And so if you haven't read it, because it's likely that you haven't and you do not wish to be spoiled.
Copyright 2011.
There you go. Then you should turn off the podcast now. Because we're about to discuss the book in its entirety.
Yes, and I'd spoil a plot for you, but I'm not sure there's a plot.
The plot is the good guys win.
Basically, yes.
But I don't really know if that's a spoiler.
Yeah, this one, there's not really a spoiler bomb for this book. But more on that subject.
H is a girl.
H is a girl.
Yes, that's kind of spoilery.
I guess it's kind of. Yeah.
But I don't think it would ruin your reading of the book.
Yeah.
Unless you were.
Unless you're just a tool.
What? It's just a girl. Girls can't like video games. That's stupid.
I thought this was a boys' book.
Spoiler alert, Ready Player One is not a boys' book. It is just a total nerd's book.
Yes.
So why did we choose Ready Player One?
Multiple requests. Not all of them electronic, but a lot of people I know have requested this, as well as at least one listener, and it's fairly big in the science fiction world, I suppose.
Yeah, I've seen a pretty good amount of it around the internet.
Yeah.
I remember reading a review for it when it first came out in a magazine, so, I mean, it's been on the radar for a while.
Yeah, I've heard people gush about it a little bit.
Supposedly a good book for nerds.
Mostly people have gushed about it when they've talked about it.
Yes.
I haven't heard anyone say, oh, it was okay.
Which, another spoiler alert?
Yeah, another spoiler alert.
We're not going to gush about this book. Ben and I actually had some issues with it.
Yeah, didn't hate it.
No, definitely not the worst thing I've even read for this podcast.
Not even close. Let's see, there's 50 Shades of Grey. And then somewhere above that is Dracula. And
yep. A Chocolate War for me is below this book.
And somewhere above Dracula is something else.
Scarlet Letter?
Scarlet Letter.
Although
know,
that was a lot of... Scarlet Letter. That was good. I don't know. Anyways. Well, it's no... The Fault in Our Stars.
No, not by any means.
Which Ben and I pooped our pants over.
Yeah, we gushed about that book.
So you said it's pretty big in the science fiction community. We also had a couple other genre tags for it.
Yeah, I also referred to it as Nerdgasm, which I'm pretty sure is in one of the blurbs, actually.
I feel like that was termed by, coined by John Scalzi, actually.
Oh, actually, I think you're right. One of my favorites.
Yeah. And then another description I saw of it was nostalgia porn.
Very accurate.
I really liked.
Yeah.
So we're going to classify it as a science fiction nerdgasm nostalgia porn mash.
I like it.
Ben, what's our plot synopsis?
80s. Oh, shit. I need to include a plot.
There's a lot of 80s in this book.
Oh my god, there's a... OMFG, there's a lot of 80s in this book.
And I was listening to the more recent podcasts and realized that we've been forgetting to do short plot synopses. Oops. And I don't know if anyone's caring about these or not.
Kevin, if you're out there, this is for you.
So yeah, I figured we'd give it a try again. So basically, this billionaire named James Halliday, who created The Oasis, an incredibly popular virtual reality, dies, but instead of leaving his billions to somebody, he sets up this epic hunt for an Easter egg he's buried somewhere in this giant world. So there's a group of people called Gunters who have been searching for the keys they need to get to the gates, they need to get to the egg. Very, very questy.
Yes, very video gamey plot.
And it's been 5 years, no one's made any progress, and our protagonist, Wade Watts, a.k.a. Percival, manages to figure out a clue to find the first key, and everything basically explodes from there. It's a race of the nerds versus the evil corporate machine to get to the end. And with the help of his buddies, Wade ultimately gets to the egg first and gets the billions.
Gets the power up and wins the game.
Yep. He actually does have an extra life.
Yep.
Very, very apt. Mm. So, the main setting of this book, when we talk about settings, we usually talk about real places, but in this case, the most important setting is definitely not in the real world.
No, it's the virtual world, the Oasis, which stands for something, but it's not really important what.
Simulated something, yeah. Something.
And it is basically like an MMO on steroids. That's a massively multiplayer online game, for those of you who aren't hip to the lingo, by the way.
It's World of Warcraft, plus Facebook, plus eBay, plus Amazon, plus...
It's basically all the biggest parts of the internet welded together, cubed.
Yeah. And you access it with your little reality virtual visor and your gloves, and you...
And if you have the money, it can be fully immersive every sense. You can buy rigs where you can actually be, like, running.
Yeah.
And moving your body makes your avatar in the game actually move that way. And it's a pretty cool little VR world that has been created for this book.
Yeah, and it's like we were saying, it's not just for entertainment. A lot of it is, you know, there's multiple worlds, so people have created Middle Earth on a world, and people have created, you know, there's a World of Warcraft world, and a video game, tons of video game worlds, yeah. All sorts of stuff, but then there's also things like a world for public school students, who are no longer physically going to school, but log into the Oasis to go to school.
Because you can save a bunch of money running schools that way without having to build and maintain physical infrastructure.
It sounds fairly effective, too, the way they do it.
Yeah.
The kids actually seem to learn.
The kids actually can have less opportunity to screw around during class online, at least, than they do right now.
Uh-huh.
Like, you could stare out the window or take a nap wherever you were at home, but your avatar in the classroom can't cause any disruption of any form. You can't run off and start looking at videos like you could on your phone if you were a modern student. It mm-hmm. restricts, during class, you're restricted to only class-related activities.
Yep.
It doesn't sound terrible.
Sounds pretty interesting, although I do feel like I would miss the physical interactions with people.
Right. I think socially, the schools would be very different in a completely online type of setting. I mean, there's a lot of interest, I think, to be drawn from the setting of this book.
Oh, yes.
I'm actually a little bit mixed on that, because I think the idea of a virtual reality, even a totally immersive one, is not all that original at this point. And so I want to take a couple points off for that, but at the same time, just the scope of this particular world is so huge, and that he envisions it instead of being a snow crash sort of thing, where it was kind of like a hyper-reality almost, but where a very certain sort of crowd hung out in the coolest parts of the virtual world. This is more like it's actually replaced large parts of reality for a large segment of the population.
Yeah, we should mention that the real world setting, one of the reasons the Oasis is so popular in this book, is because the real world's gone to shit. All the stuff that's happening now times 100.
I would actually describe the real world in this book as, because it's in 2030 or 40, it's the relatively near future. To me, it is the most hysterical environmentalists from the 1970s projections of what the year 2000 would look like. Essentially, that's the real world setting in this book.
Yeah, global warming, all...
fossil fuels running really low.
Uh-huh. Just the poverty, or the impoverished population has exploded. You know, the gap between the rich and the poor is
crazy. Yeah, throw in the economic issues of recent years never really fully being recovered from and actually getting worse. So the infrastructure across the country is falling apart. It's not a very pleasant world to live in unless you are very wealthy or you just spend all your time on the Oasis.
Yes. So, yeah. Well, I want to talk more about the Oasis, but I feel like we should
I'd like to save it for more of our issues section anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that's where a lot of the... I think where there is depth to be drawn from this book, it happens because of the setting, whether intentionally or not. I mean, both of those things, I think, really.
Okay, well, our protagonist, let's talk about some of the characters. Yes,
Wade Watts.
Slash... Percival, or...
spelled Parzival.
We might call him Parzival a couple times.
That's what I called him in my head when I was reading it, even though I knew it was Percival.
He tells you it's the old English spelling of Percival, who's the guy who found the Grail.
Right.
But it's first person, so that's one of the reasons we know he's the protagonist. And it's told in past tense. So we know that he's telling us what has happened. He even says at the beginning, I was the first guy to find the copper key, and I'm going to tell you what happened. So what do we know about Wade?
Well, he's poor.
Yeah.
He
lives in...
parents are gone. Lives in what's called a stack, which is literally a stack of trailer homes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like a... lattice work of girders and such that they're mounted on, but yeah.
It's like a trailer park, but 12 stories high, or 20 stories high.
Yeah. This is where a lot of people live now, because of all the aforementioned issues in the world. He is hunting for this Easter egg, and by the way, James Halliday and his Oasis was so successful, he's like Bill Gates squared. The billions he left behind in his will in this hunt is over $200 billion.
Yeah. This guy was rich as shit.
Yeah. And so he's been hunting for 5 years. He's become totally immersed in the life of James Halliday, who has pretty much sent his hunt up as, like, the most... ego trippy.
Oh my god.
Posthumous.
Yeah.
Act ever.
He leaves this video behind telling people, in order to find the egg I've hidden, you have to figure out, you know, these clues, and part of it's, or all of it's based on his own life experiences and interests. And because he grew up in the 80s, James Halliday, he's fucking obsessed with the 80s, and everyone who's searching for these Easter eggs, they try to learn every last minute detail about his life. I mean, these people are all James Halliday scholars.
Yeah.
He loved this! That could be a clue! And I was just sitting there thinking, this guy is so full of himself.
I mean, and when you get into the tasks and what you have to do to clear his gates and such, it turns out you need to be that kind of James Halliday scholar. It's like,
yes.
Repeat War Games line for line.
No problem, I've seen it 20 times.
Whoa.
Oh my dear God.
Or be a freaking awesome Joust player, which if you've never...
Have you heard of that?
I have. Okay. I've played it.
Oh, damn.
And it is one of the most difficult games I have ever tried to play.
I'd never even heard of Joust.
Okay. back in the day, some of you who are even just a couple years younger than I am may not realize this, but video games used to be freaking hard. Now most of them not so much. It's not like I'm longing for the days when you had to try every level 400 times to beat it, because that was annoying. It's really the medium has become more about storytelling and puzzle solving instead of learning the exact series of repetitive actions to get through some impossible level, Battletoads. And so, yes, those of you who know a gamer, if you've ever heard the phrase Nintendo hard, that's what they're talking about. Because 8-bit Nintendo, way harder than anything on the PS3.
That's really funny to me.
Yeah. And Joust is... I've never played it in the arcade, the actual arcade box before, but I have played it in emulators, and it's frickin' hard.
Well, okay. I mean... This is the sort of guy who makes you score a perfect score on Pac-Man.
Yeah, which has only been done 20-odd times ever. And you have to know some obscure piece of trivia about the last level to do it, too, yeah. On top of that.
I was cracking up when I was reading it, though, because I can never make it past, like, level 3. I know. I'm gonna be the worst at this book. I would fail so hard. But yeah, I mean, these people have to know the craziest, tiniest little bits of trivia to figure anything out.
Yeah, which really takes me to my first major beef with the book. And that's that it is just... I mean, the first... When I was describing the book to Gabs, because I had my hands on it before she did. So, you know, the first third is actually pretty boring. The middle third is kind of eh, and then the last third picks up a bit because stuff is actually happening. But the first, like, 80 pages is just a series of 80s references and frequently really nerdy 80s references with no other substance to it. And if you're not entertained just by the presence of these references, I just don't think you would be enjoying it very much.
Yeah. Ben told me that, and then I was reading it, and I think he finally got the copper key around page 80, and I said, oh, something finally happened. That was a problem that I had, too, and one of the reasons I've been trying to figure it out a little bit, because I've read books with tons of narration in them before and little dialogue, and there are huge stretches of this book that are mostly narration, because... Wade's on his own trying to figure stuff out and just describing the world he lives in to you.
Right.
I couldn't really decide if it was all of the 80s references or if his narration is just not interesting enough. And that was an issue I had with his character, is that his narration is pretty straightforward. He tells you everything that's going on. It's not spiced up. I don't know the right word. He doesn't use really flowery language to describe right. everything. He just says, this happened, this is going on, this is what the Oasis looks like. But then when he talks, a lot of his dialogue is super smartassy, in a way you would expect someone writing a smartass teenager to write dialogue.
Right.
I felt like. And for me, that juxtaposition of, you know, oh, here's... two pages of extremely straightforward description, and the first thing he says is, you know, oh, you're such an asshat.
Right.
I'm like, that doesn't fit with your inner dialogue to me.
Right.
I'm confused.
You don't sound like someone who is enough of a loser to think it's hip to say asshat.
Asshat's a great insult.
It is a great insult, but only when used ironically.
They should have called each other chodes.
They should have. That would have been better. Yeah, and that's kind of a theme a bit in this book, the weak characterization. No one is all that interesting. And Wade's the only one who's actually inconsistent, just because we get so much of him.
Uh-huh.
But Yeah, I agree. And, I mean, the straightforward thing is not a problem. I think there's a lot with this setting that can be done that's interesting. And a lot of what he does do is pretty interesting with just the setting. But really, just leaning so heavily on the references to create interest in the first chunk of the book, it was a little hard to stick with it for me. And that actually is related to a peeve of mine, which maybe I'll get into for just a second.
Okay.
Which is people my age who think they're children of the 80s and who have decided they love things like this. because I was born in 1982, and by the time you are pop culturally aware, even if you're really precocious about it, what are you, like 8 or 9?
Yeah.
Which would make it 1990, by the way.
Well, it's better than people my age thinking they're children of the 80s.
Who were born in, like, 87?
Yeah. You were 2 years old in 1990.
It's like, come on, guy. Admit you're a child of the 90s. I know it doesn't sound as cool because we haven't had as much retro kish nostalgia over the 90s yet.
I think the 90s are way better than the 80s.
Well, so do I, because the 80s, objectively speaking, blow. And if I'm offending anyone who's listening to this, then get over it.
Does anyone actually like the 80s unironically? I'm just wondering.
Because everything about the 80s is bad. And if you disagree, I refer you to cinema, television, music, clothing, any of the pop culture.
Ronald Reagan. Let's get the political! Politics!
Oh, man.
Okay, anywho.
Now having offended everyone over the age of 30, of which we have zero listeners, probably.
Our dad.
Oh, yeah. Well, he doesn't care. He's not a child of the 80s.
That's true. He thinks the 80s suck, too. The Royals won the World Series in the 80s.
See, the Royals were the world champions in 1985, the exact center of the 80s, and that just proves how much the 80s suck. It's a decade that's so bad, the Kansas City Royals can win the World Series.
lovely. Yes. This book is definitely 80s obsessed, full of 80s references. I didn't get a lot of them. I got some of them. I've seen War Games, and I've seen Monty Python on the Holy Grail, and Family Ties. Like, I know some of it.
Right.
But, like, I'd never heard of Joust, for example. And so, for me, one of the problems I had with the 80s references is when I recognized them, it was fun. Like, when one of the gates was based around Rush, I actually just cracked up. But, when I didn't get one, because I've never played Tiger Chinese, whatever the second game was, Jade Tiger or whatever, and then he doesn't really describe it to you, he just says, oh, it's this game where you're this kind of warrior, and I beat the first level, and then I just, you know, I went through and I beat it at the end, and it was kind of hard. Like, in a paragraph, and I'm going,
right.
That doesn't help set the stage for me at all, because I didn't bother to get online and look up the reference.
Yeah, I think being familiar with the... but for me, being familiar with the references even, because I probably caught 80 to 90% of those references, and the ones I didn't know exactly, I at least knew something pretty similar to it. You go, oh, well, it was a text adventure game. I'm like, oh, I've seen text adventure games. Or it was, you know, this... actually, some of the ones that were... the ones that I probably enjoyed the most were the hilarious English spellings of anime from the 1980s.
I did get a couple of those.
Which were super obscure, and I haven't seen or even heard of any of them outside of that book, but like Spider-Man being Supaida-Man.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That was pretty awesome. Giant robots.
Right, but again, even though that amused me to read it, like, if it had been 80 pages of that, I still would have been like, lol, this book is hilarious, because I still would have been looking for a little more substance underneath that. Though in the last third of the book, that was done much better, weaving that together.
Yes.
Let's talk about a couple of the other characters.
Okay, we have H,
who, as we mentioned, is secretly a girl.
Yes.
But who is a dude for most of the story.
A white dude.
A white dude who turns out to be a black lesbian.
Yes.
which I was kind of halfway expecting. I don't know if I'd read a spoiler at some point, or if that was, or if I just like to.
We just think that
guys are actually girls when I read.
Tries
books.
To do that because of his Lord of the Flies bit.
Yeah.
Trying to turn Simon into a girl.
It's kind of an annoying anime trope, and for those of you who haven't figured it out yet, I am a giant anime nerd, and so I sometimes think it's coming in other genres, and I am usually disappointed.
Yeah. So yeah, H is a girl, and presumably part of that's thrown in to say, oh, you know, look, we have Artemis, but look, girls are just as capable of guys, and half of the team that ended up finding the Easter egg are actually girls. And I mean, there's something to be said of a black girl going, oh, if I present myself as a white man, people are going to take me more seriously. There's a little bit of social commentary there.
Yeah.
And sadly, social commentary that I even think is partially true.
Yeah.
But then, other than that, we know that H knows 80s trivia, likes the game Joust.
Yep.
And is equally full of witty dialogue that sounds exactly like Wade's. And likes to fist bump him.
Right.
They do a lot.
They bro fist.
But do we know anything else about H?
No. And, I mean, H is, tries to stay under the radar as part of that. Like, you know, H's 80s James Halliday related proclivities, but H has done a better job than the rest of these elite Gunters of keeping
your wraps.
Yeah, keeping the true identity hidden, which is good for him, her.
Well, her.
As things get uncovered. Because the corporate folks who are also trying to find this Easter egg and basically take control of the Oasis, when they find your real identity, they are not above having you killed.
Yes.
In fact, they try to kill Wade, and they successfully kill Daito. Or no,
Shoto
is not Daito. Shoto.
Yeah, they're interchangeable.
Yeah, the pair of Japanese buddies who are basically in the book to go, look, Japanese guys.
Well.
And that's their entire personality traits, too, by the way. They're obsessed with honor, and yep. They bow a lot. Because they're Japanese.
They were both Hikikomori.
That's true.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Which is a real thing. One of the things I was just going to say about H is the relationship between H and Wade is we know they're best friends because Wade tells us we're best friends. But that's about the only reason we know that why they're best friends.
He's allowed into the awesome hangout even though he's only like level
three or something,
yeah.
But it was kind of the same thing for me as Wade and Artemis's relationship is once Wade had, you know, fallen in love with Artemis. He said, oh, we started talking all the time, and now we're kind of dating, and I love her. And I felt it was kind of the same thing with H of, well, we started talking a lot and found out we had the same interests, so then we were best friends.
Yeah, that's kind of the limit of characterization in this book.
Like, what did you talk about? What are your interests? How do you interact? Like,
it's show, don't tell, right?
Yeah.
And then, for that matter, I mean, we might as well start getting into Artemis here. Artemis. Gabs has some pretty big issues with the romance, which she pretty much just summarized, but we don't know a ton about her character either, other than that she's also a giant Halliday nerd scholar mm-hmm. person.
She apparently has a really popular blog.
Yeah.
And is super witty, and I guess her avatar is kind of hot. And she is actually the first person to discover the location of the Copper Key, but because Wade is better at Joust than her, he's the first one to actually obtain the Copper Key.
Right.
But then she's the first one to discover the location of the second key as well. So she's up on her shit. She's smart. She keeps saying things like, I have to stay focused on the hunt, and we can't, you know, afford to become friends, and blah, blah. But I feel like that's most of what we get from her. And at the same time, you know, she's trying to stay mysterious because she tells Wade we shouldn't tell each other a lot about ourselves because it's better to remain anonymous. And so, to some degree, H and Artemis both have reasons for remaining kind of distant. But at the same time, we then get from Wade's narrative that he talks to them all the time and they get along super well. So why can't we see some of that so we at least understand why he likes her so much?
We don't get to see a whole lot of the relationships as relationships. They are just facts. Which is frustrating because we both like good characters. And we're both told that these are all good characters. But we don't have evidence of them being good characters.
And I mean, I think we've proven that if we read a book with no plot and it's just good characters hanging out, we're okay with that.
Yeah, I'm fine with that, especially in an interesting setting. Like, if they if it had just been them bouncing around the Oasis, having a good time, and they'd actually been interesting characters and just going through all these interesting settings and doing all these things and all these different zones, I would have been entertained as hell.
Yeah.
Even if there was no actual plot, if it was just this episodic thing of like, oh, we went to this planet and escaped this danger using these neat things.
Yeah, like if we actually got to see Wade and Dido and Dido and Shoto get the Ultraman tablet. Like we actually got to experience that quest. Because there was a little bit in there where Wade is trying to chat up Artemis. It's like 3 pages of like a chat.
Yeah.
I really liked that.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
I was expecting more of it.
I think Ernest Cline has the ability to do that.
It'll
be interesting to see what happens in his next book. Assuming there will be another one, because this one did reasonably well.
And another thing I feel like we should point out is it is Ernest Cline's first novel.
Yes.
And obviously people can write amazing first novels, but if you write one that a lot of people like, which a lot of people liked this one, and other people who are more critical, like us, have read and like it okay, but can see some potential in it. I mean, he could be writing really good books. You know, your first book isn't the pinnacle of your ability.
For most people, it's not, no.
And I don't want to, like, sound like I'm bagging on him too much, but...
No, because neither of us hated this book. It's just that... You know, maybe a little bit, and I'm jumping ahead by addressing this now, probably, but just, I think part of my reaction to it is that it was talked up to me from people I know who read it. No one I know just said, oh, it was interesting, or, oh, hey, you might think this is interesting, or like, it was so good, I really loved it, or, you know, just based purely on the references, I guess.
One of those things where, people talk up something so much and then you finally experience it and you're like, eh.
Yeah.
That's happened to me multiple times.
And if I'd gone into it a little blinder, I might have enjoyed it a little more. Because like I said, I did get most of the references. And the whole reference-based entertainment thing is... I mean, it exists these days. You can go out in front of a group of people and just... reference things and they'll think it's entertaining. You don't actually have to have a narrative or anything to say. Which, you know, isn't necessarily a criticism. I mean, it kind of is, but like, I do it too.
Yeah, you do.
I certainly do, yeah, so.
Okay, let's see. What else do we want to say about this? We're talking about some of our issues then.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Okay. So, one of the things that I was debating is, you know, at the end is the message that escaping into the Oasis is ultimately a bad thing, or is it actually a good thing?
Yeah, I think that the message you're supposed to have by the end is that real life is better than disappearing into the virtual world. But one thing that when we were outlining, one of the things that I was arguing a little bit was that you could read this book and take away, well, actually, the virtual world's way better than the real world. Just objectively speaking, your actual economic status, certainly when you're starting up, can affect who you are inside the game. But Percival has nothing at the beginning, and then by leveling, and I mean, it helped to be the first one to find the key, because that brought him some celebrity, but mm-hmm. he was able to leverage that and like have all this cool stuff within the game world. And when you're online, that's all that really matters. If you're a high level character with awesome stuff and able to make money off of it, and he was making real money off of it yeah. too, even if most of it was getting spent with online as yeah. well. But I mean, there's some opportunity there. When you have the full tactile setup like he had, you can... it's not like you're just sitting there staring into a screen, letting your jaw slacken slowly. And actually, I really like that fitness program
yeah.
that he had set up.
It locks you out of the Oasis until you burn a certain number of calories.
Right. And so dude was probably in decent shape.
I was like, I wish I had that.
Yeah, right?
I could use that.
And you can go to school in the online environment, and lots, I'm sure, most people who do their business in the Oasis probably do all of their business in the Oasis.
Uh-huh.
You only need a virtual storefront if you're selling stuff you use in that world. And
Misfits can make friends.
Yeah.
I mean, Wade made all of his friends online.
There are a lot of benefits to it. Now, you can't go make out with someone in the Oasis.
That's true.
In a really meaningful way. So, that's a downside.
Uh-huh.
Which is basically what the end is saying.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, obviously, you have to live some portion of your life outside of the Oasis, but spending 10 or 12 hours a day inside of it doesn't sound that terrible to me.
Uh-huh. And the other thing, one of the other reasons I think you can kind of debate it is partway through the book, I started thinking, oh, maybe at the end when they get all of his money, they'll end up destroying the Oasis and telling people to come back to the real world and fix that instead. In Halliday's avatar, Anorak, the yeah. wizard, does show him a button that he can press and just shut down the entire thing if he needs to. And I thought maybe he would press it. But that's not going to happen.
Right. That's actually one of my little points of interest for this book. I like that that got thrown in. It was kind of a red herring. Because it does make you wonder, oh, is he going to use that button now that he has it? And no, of course not.
No. He's freaking immortal, man.
Yes, he is
in
now...
the Oasis.
On the online world, he is now a god. And he, even though he split the prize with his friends, he still has like $80 billion in his pocket.
For sure.
And Artemis does want to use hers to make the world a better place.
Or at least try.
Since we kind of referenced that obliquely a moment ago. And, you know, I don't know how much good you can do, because $80 billion isn't very much to save a world with. But...
Well, what about our other message in here, which we get through IOI?
Yeah, okay. So, the other conflict is the whole corporate interests versus individual interests.
Mm-hmm.
Which is certainly relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Because IOI, which, what does that stand for again? It doesn't matter. They're
international.
They're a company that controls online gateways and basically wants to take control of the Oasis, so they have a whole department dedicated to finding Halliday's Easter egg.
Yeah.
And they're mostly giant dicks about it, but they have all the money and resources of any group, of any large group of Gunters.
Uh-huh.
They're as powerful as any of the big clans out there, if not more so.
Yep.
And they largely run around and act like douchebags, but they're all dressed in the same uniform.
Uh-huh.
They're called the Sixers because they all just, their online names are all just their employee numbers, which for their department all start with sixes. They have all this state-of-the-art equipment. They have hacked their rigs, so if someone runs into something they don't get, they can patch in the expert on that particular aspect of Halliday's life.
And they're cheating.
They are cheating. And, well, I mean, the rules are pretty open-ended, but it doesn't feel right, one of those things. And when they go and find the copper key, for example, they cordon off the area and throw up a shield so no one else can get in.
Yeah.
And eventually everyone else gets pissed and batters their way through.
Yeah, the other Gungers are pissed off enough to set off nukes and stuff.
You're right. But they buy themselves a lot of time doing that. And, you know, they throw Shoto out the window and they bomb Wade's stack to the ground, and fortunately his favorite place to hang out on Oasis is a little hiding place that is not actually in his trailer.
Kills everyone he knows, though.
But kills everyone he knows, which he feels bad about for roughly a page.
And we don't really care about
them. And we don't really care about them anyway. And they're just, they're very ruthless. They're in single-minded pursuit of this goal, which will make them even wealthier and more powerful than they already are. Which is a lot how people view corporate America.
Yeah.
Fairly or not.
Yeah, and ultimately, the guy, Sorrentino, the guy in charge of the Sixers, who's basically just a ruthless dickbag, gets arrested for all the stuff that he's done.
Yes, Wade is able to expose him in the real world.
Mm-hmm. And presumably spend a bunch of money making sure that he actually gets punished for what he's done.
True.
But Iowa is definitely not a good thing, and I'd say anti-corporation feelings run pretty strongly throughout the book.
Yeah.
Because one of the awesome things about the Oasis is that it's free to access. I think you have to pay 25 cents when you first sign up.
Right.
But then otherwise, technically it's free, although you do have to have money to buy new clothes for your avatar and travel around and stuff.
Teleport around the giant universe that is the Oasis.
Which you can apparently get through, you know, battling people and creatures and stuff like that. But it still helps to have money. But IOI wants to take it and charge a monthly fee and start privatizing it all so that it becomes basically a hangout for the wealthy.
Start putting up ads because, of course, that's on the internet today. That's one of the top 10 things that people get their panties in a bunch of that. I used to like this site. Now they have advertisements. Well, they have server fees.
Yeah, I've read blogs and stuff before where they go, sorry, I decided to put ads up because it's going to help me pay for everything. I never begrudge people that. I can ignore ads. I never click on that shit.
Yeah, there you go.
We mostly hit all our points. Let's just, I mean, we've already hit on this a little bit, but what about the writing and the pacing and such of the book?
All right, so I would have liked it a lot better if stuff had happened sooner than page 80.
Yep.
I would have liked it a lot better if characters had been deeper.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed some of the references. Not every reference I knew made me go, oh, I know what that is, that makes me happy. But a couple of, like, the flavor of a couple of the references I enjoyed. And, you know, I didn't think it was poorly written as much as I just thought it had a lot of, it had some systemic issues.
There were interesting moments, definitely interesting things, because we talked about the Oasis for a while. That's a really cool setting.
And even the references themselves, like, this book was either Ernest Cline is the biggest 80s nerd in the history of the world, or he did a ton of research, or both,
yeah,
to make this happen, and, you know, that's not my specific form of nerdery, but I can certainly appreciate that level of nerdery.
Yeah, I was telling Ben, actually, when we were outlining for this book, that if Ready Player One had been based on a guy who created a virtual reality who was obsessed with medieval Europe, and all the gates were based around, you know, like, gate one is recreate the Bayeux Tapestry. You know, oh, King Harold, and then they go, oh, obviously, King Harold died by getting an arrow in the left eye, not the right eye. You know, that sort of nerdery might have, like, tickled me more.
Yes.
And even if it had all the same issues as this book, maybe if it was more my brand of nerd,
right,
it would have cracked me up more. Although, I don't, no one cares about medieval. But I just think that, I just imagine.
I was going to hop in there with a Notre Dame Organum reference, but I realize that's obscure even for medieval. So.
Oh, the Novum Organum?
It's going to start getting to the music side of it.
Ah. I think you're trying Francis Bacon for a second there.
No.
He's not medieval.
Let's talk about Leonin and Periton Gabs.
Never heard of that.
13th century. yeah.
Oh, what about
church music?
Oh, shit. What's her name? There was, like, an awesome woman who was, like, a seer slash saint from that time.
Yeah, we're going to throw down our own obscure references. Take that, Ready Player One.
Anyway.
Anyway.
So we can appreciate the level of nerd it takes to be to create something
and
like this.
I could even have been more okay with bathing in all of the references if there had just been more stuff going on and if we'd been getting to know the characters more. Like, you could take all these references that get made, and instead of him saying, oh, well, I was thinking of this because of this thing, and then I ran into this, which is related to this thing, and instead, like, it'd come up in conversation, or, oh, hey, yeah, let's go do this together, and, oh, here, we're running into this reference here, and, oh, man, I always get stuck on this part. Oh, we just had to do this obscure thing. Oh, that's so awesome! And, like, they're bantering and enjoying each other through it. That'd be a really different way of approaching it.
Yeah, his figuring out the riddle for the copper key while he's sitting in Latin class, and then Ludos jumps out at him. I really liked that moment. And then when he was trying to figure out the second gate, and he just casually mentions, I was looking at a box of Captain Crunch and happened to think of all this stuff. And that didn't feel organic at all.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the way he discovered the first way, but not the way he discovered about the whistle and the Captain Crunch. And if more of that discovery had come from interaction, then I would have liked that too. And there's one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, in movie reviews sometimes, you'll see critics say something like, so-and-so is likable but can't carry a movie. So whenever someone makes a movie that focuses so much on one character.
Right.
And like when I Am Legend came out, people were saying, oh, Will Smith does a good job of carrying I Am Legend for most of the time by himself.
Right.
Even though the ending is the stupidest thing ever. And then sometimes movies come out and they go, well, that one character carrying the movie does not work so well, you know. You're not Tom Hanks in Castaway.
Right.
Stop trying.
Like, some people just aren't great as a leading man, but are great as a supporting role. Uh-huh. That sort of thing.
And I felt like one of the things that I had a hard time connecting to in this book is that Wade is basically carrying the entire book by himself. We just get so much of his narration of everything, more so than his interactions with other people. And I was never interested in the big chunks of his narration and him being on his own. And I think for me, he just wasn't enough of a leading man who could carry the book through. I needed more.
I think that's fair. If you're going to have a character who's giving pretty direct narration and not interacting with a lot of other characters frequently, then stuff needs to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably a good rule of thumb for writing.
Stuff needs to be happening.
I like a first-person narrative, especially. Because if they're not leading a rich inner life of mind, so to speak, then they actually need to be involved in stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like Kurt Vonnegut said, every sentence either has to advance the plot or explore characterization.
Yeah, well, maybe that's part of why his books are short, too.
Yeah. So ultimately, or I guess context relevance.
Okay, well, it's not too hard to look at this online world and see the grown-up, more grown-up version of our internet. Or I was talking with Alan last night about the book just a little bit, and he said that one of the things this book kind of implied was that being involved that deeply in the virtual world is maybe not the best thing ever. But then he said, yeah, but you know what? If, like, I could get rid of my phone and have data directly, take in data more directly in some way, I would do it in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there's a little bit of that. There is the corporate and the environmental part of it.
Corporate message is much bigger. I feel like the environmental message is just background to...
Yeah, it is. It's not explored. It's kind of there. But, I mean, why mention it if you didn't think it was plausible? And so there's a little bit of that going on. And then, yeah, I guess... We didn't talk about this earlier, but if we wanted to go a layer deeper than was intended, I'm sure you could talk a little bit about human nature and how people are secretive about finding the big cool thing because they could keep it all to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And how the Sixers are being dicky and how those are things people do. But yep. I don't think that was really what we're supposed to draw from this. But, I mean, there are things in there.
And I think one of the other things that we did think about was, at the end, you know, ultimately, all the main characters are giant nerds.
Yeah.
And they're the protagonists, the heroes of the book.
Yeah.
And they all build friendships with each other. So, you know, nerds can make friends and be important and accomplish things, too.
Right. Yeah, you know, the... nerd shout-outs I enjoyed a lot more than the constant stream of 80s references. Though, yeah, I did want to throw this one out there. The Cory Doctorow, Will Wheaton being the president and vice president of Oasis for, like, the last 30 years was pretty hilarious to me.
Will Wheaton reads the audiobook version
that
of this.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because Will Wheaton is basically the president of the internet.
Yeah, I know. People love his shit. The president of the internet. Oh, mother... I feel like I was going to say something.
Questions?
No, we didn't write anything down.
Yeah. Do we have any questions?
I don't know.
I don't think we did. I think we were glad it was done.
Well, what's our verdict?
My verdict is eh.
Yeah, me too. I didn't think it was bad, but I did definitely get bored at points throughout, and I would not recommend this book to my friends who are not interested in video games or other nerdy things. My friends who are, you know, use the internet solely for Facebook and online banking and checking their email.
Right.
I would not tell them to read Ready Player One.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure who I would recommend it to. Not that I disliked it. I mean, we've picked at it a lot. But I actually had heard that a lot of gamers have problems with this book.
Oh, really?
Which I have not... popped on the internet to find out what they're saying, because I didn't want to wade into that big pool of hate.
Yeah.
It is very difficult. Some of you may not realize this, but it's very difficult, even within, like, nerd sub-communities, to get two people to agree on anything. And there's definitely a tendency that, to say, when someone doesn't say something exactly the way that you think about it, that people start arguing over nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll come in and someone will be like, I loved this thing. And they go, oh yeah, it was really good. I would give it 5 out of 5 stars. But here's like an issue I had. And they're like, you don't like it the same way I do. You suck. You're like Hitler.
Yeah.
Like, actually, I do like it. I just was trying to talk about it.
Relevant, by the way. And for any NPR listeners, Central Standard did a show this morning about internet humor is pervading the real world. Your Hitler reference reminded me.
I heard the promo for that. That's probably why that was in my head.
Yes, but I definitely agree with you. There's, you know, the typical internet, this TV show is in its third season, so it automatically isn't like it used to be. It totally sucks now.
Right. Man, it used to be good.
That's a thing that happens.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's also the, if you criticize it, then you can't like it.
Right.
Huge thing that happens later as well.
Well, I could, yeah. Well, if you criticize it, then you don't like it, right? Like, if you criticize the war, you don't support the troops.
I had someone get pissed at me the other day for making a joke about that.
Uh-oh.
To be fair, it was a little more rude than just, I don't support the war. All right. Well, what are you reading right now?
I am reading Looking for Alaska by John Green because I wanted to read it after we both had a bookgasm over The Fault in Our Stars.
I just started reading, I think I'm 2 chapters in, to The Casual Vacancy, which is the new book by J.K. Rowling for adults.
Ah, yes.
So I don't know if I like it or not yet, because I think I'm page 15.
Oh yeah, I also forgot to mention that on a much, much nerdier note, I also just finished reading a comic book collection of Marvel Zombies versus Army of Darkness.
Oh man. How did you not love this book?
I thought the book was okay. I didn't have to force myself to read it like I did with a couple of things we've done.
All right, so if you would like to if you would like to leave us a comment, our website is www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Yes, you could also email us novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
And follow us on Twitter @novelideaspod.
And if you listen on iTunes, of course, leave ratings, reviews, comments, snacks. I don't know. What else can you leave on iTunes?
You can just type novel ideas into the search bar now and find us.
Sweet.
It's amazing.
It's perfect.
And so next week we are doing, I don't really know if this counts as a series because we're only doing two, but we're doing a little mini play series. So next week we are reading The Crucible by Arthur Miller, which for anyone who didn't have to read it in high school, if I go and claim that everyone had to read it in high school, I'm going to get a lot of complaints.
I know. It's like, I read it in high school, but
It's about the Salem witch trials, but also about McCarthyism, which we will discuss next week. And then we're going to follow it up with another play the following week, so.
So, be ready for that.
Yep.
They're easier to read, so try to keep up.
Yeah, Thanksgiving is upon us, and
hey, we're hoping that now we finally got past Ready Player One, which is apparently our punctuality kryptonite.
We'll get back on track.
That we'll actually be able to do this every week.
Yeah.
I guess that's all.
That's all I have.
Yeah. So, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Throwing a party with no one still alive. Waiting for an invitation to arrive.